Let's humble our hearts before Almighty Yahweh. Kind Father in heaven, we are so grateful to come before you this day on the Sabbath day to honor you and to learn more of your truth. We know that each day we are tried and tested by what we believe, and we know that only through your Sabbath and the strength you give us on these days will we be sustained. So we thank you, Almighty Yahweh, for each Sabbath that we have, that we can come here and honor you and learn more of your ways. We pray that you'll be with us now as we study your word and learn of your truths as we go through each and every passage and just glean what you have for us there. For we know that your word is truth, and it's the truth that we need more than ever these days. So now we ask for your guidance and strength, and be with us also through this day, that it might be a joy for each of us as we honor your Sabbath day. In Yahshua's name we pray. Hallelujah. You may be seated. Well, the caller said, it doesn't really matter what you call him. He's the same G-O-D, and he knows who you mean regardless. Well, in Exodus 32, I got to reading this, and I got to asking myself, Yahweh surely knew that Aaron's golden calf was just a representation of him, didn't he? That Aaron was just expressing his own notion about Yahweh, wasn't he? Yahweh understood. No matter what image or likeness Aaron produced, surely Yahweh realized that Aaron was just worshiping him a little differently this day, didn't he? After he made the calf, Aaron even proclaimed a feast to Yahweh, Exodus 32, verse 5. Now, what could be wrong with that? And they even offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before they rose up to play, it says in verse 6. What is wrong with that? Well, Yahweh's response is in verse 7. Yahweh said unto Moses, get down, for your people which have brought, what you have brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. Yahweh's idea of what constitutes his acceptable worship certainly was not the same as what the people had in mind, or what people have today when they say, it doesn't matter. One day is as good as another. One name is just as suitable as another. He knows who I mean. Verse 8, it says, they have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf, and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed thereunto, and said, these be your Elohim, O Israel, which have brought you out of the land of Egypt. You know, we can do whatever we want as far as worship of Yahweh is concerned. Anything we care to do, any way we want to do it, that we think are okay with Yahweh, and he'll come down on us like a two-ton hammer. Because there is a way that is commanded, verse 8, and there's no deviation allowed. Simple as that. The first commandment defines it all. I am Yahweh. You shall have no other mighty ones before me. Only one way. Not Jehovah, not Allah, not Buddha. Not Vishnu, Baal, Dagon, Milcom, or Molech. Only me shall you worship. Nor any mixture of any of those other worships except worship of me. Don't mix in Easter, Xmas, Sunday, common titles. That's not pure. I would invite those who think that compromise is the way to go to explain the meaning of Yahshua's statement in Matthew chapter 10, verse 34. Because there he says, think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I am not come to send peace, but a sword. Now why would he have to say that? Why would he say that I'm coming, and when I come and bring my truth, there's not going to be peace. There's going to be conflict. Well, we know the truth divides, don't we? The truth divides. And regardless of man's opinion about what it should be, Yahweh's truth is not going to be acceptable for the most part. But you can't compromise with any other belief system and believe you'll still be untainted in your worship. You can't. The scripture plainly tells us you, in 100 places you can't do that. Yahweh's truth will divide. It'll divide families. It'll divide friends. It'll divide people. And you cannot compromise, he says, with other systems. If you could, then his truth would not divide. The spirit of the golden calf says it doesn't really matter what you believe about Yahweh, but do whatever you feel in your heart is right, as long as you're sincere. It doesn't matter what name you give him. Whatever works is fine if it works for you. That's the attitude of most people today. You call the shots. You call the shots. A kind of Yahweh helps those who helps themselves. I'm looking all my life for that in the scriptures, and I cannot find it. If anybody finds that phrase, please show it to me. I'd like to know where it is. Philosophy. Philosophy of man. That's acceptable today. The belief is that Yahweh is pleased with any kind of effort that we give, as long as we really, sincerely believe we're doing it in the right way. You can pretty much live your life the way you want to, 6 days out of the week, and Yahweh will look past all of that as long as you give him some honor and glory maybe one day of the week, or at least think about him once in a while. Yahweh at one time created man in Yahweh's image, and today man creates Yahweh in his own image. So that it now appears to most people that Yahweh thinks like man thinks and believes like man believes and has values like man's values and views. He even takes on popular liberal attitudes about right and wrong. But when did anyone ever say, hey, wait a minute, what does Yahweh think, believe, ask, command, do? What does he say about things like abortion, the death penalty, sodomy, animal rights, the environment? What does he think? Maybe the one who made this universe has an opinion that we'd be well advised to heed. That is, unless it's man who is going to hand out the keys to the kingdom. There's a big difference between hearing the truth and believing and doing it, for sure. Many will hear it, few will do it, because it cuts to the heart and lays the heart open for all to see. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 4. This is what I'm talking about when I mentioned that his word is divisive. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12, for the word of Elohim is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit, under the joints and marrow, and is a discerner. Notice this, a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. How does it do that? Well, if you follow it, it shows a heart willing to obey, doesn't it? If you make up excuses, if you say it doesn't matter, if you say one worship is as good as another, that shows a thought and intent of the heart. People afraid of the scriptures don't want to consult the scriptures. They don't want to study them. Remember, old Mark Twain said, it's not what I don't understand about the Bible, it's what I do understand that bothers me. Some are apprehensive. So apprehensive that they feel they are not going to measure up. So they waffle, they equivocate, they water down the word, make it easier. They rationalize, well, no one else is living up to it either, so I'll just join them in the same boat. That's kind of how they think, if they don't even express it that way. That's basically what's their philosophy. Well, in 2 weeks, we're going to be observing the Feast of Weeks, Feast of Pentecost. And what comes to mind, of course, when we think of Pentecost is Acts chapter 2 and the giving of the Spirit at that time. You know, if we look at the, I'm not going to get into a study of that, but if we just look at the facts surrounding Acts chapter 2, we learn that there are no fewer than 15 nations represented here in this time. 15 nations with people there speaking different languages from different cultures, cultures that were widely varied in how they worshiped, and Each one had their particular mighty one that they worshipped. These people obviously were called out of that, but this was what they grew up believing, no doubt, till they were converted, just as we did before we were converted. And each adhered to an accepted religious code, no matter what faith they held. They held something. Well, the deep underlying motive of those who believe, according to, you know, whatever it is that it's not of Yahweh, is to make their life easier. Just go along with the crowd. Smooth sailing, no strife, no disappointments, no problems. We'll just do what everybody else is doing. And that's the majority. That's probably 98%. This is their philosophy. No one has to feel inferior. No one can come along and think they're superior, as they sometimes charge. This is the spirit of compromise at its worst, because it compromises truth. The lesson we find in Acts 2 at the Feast of Weeks is just the opposite. Notice verse 11 of Acts 2. Cretans and Arabians, we do hear them speak in our tongues the wonderful works of Elohim. Our tongues. And they were amazed. And were in doubt, saying one to another, what does this mean? Although they spoke different languages, different from different cultures, and obviously from different religious backgrounds, they heard the truth filtered through this gift of tongues. They heard the truth in their language. But what were they hearing? The religion of back home? No. They were hearing the truth that was spoken by Yahweh's Spirit at that time. So they asked, what does it mean? What does it mean? Peter explained that it is a fulfillment of prophecy, and whoever calls on a specific one and only one singular name of Yahweh shall be saved, verse 21. Gave a little speech. Certainly it's more than what we see here, these, what, five verses or so. But he gave a little message to explain this to these people. Many tongues present, only one truth. Many tongues, one truth. Nowhere is the importance of correct worship and one-way truth more profoundly seen than in the lessons of the tabernacle / temple that we find in the scriptures. The temple, which originated, of course, from the tabernacle, the original portable temple that we read about in Exodus, shows by its detail and how specific Yahweh commanded worship, a precise way in which he commanded the tabernacle to be built and ordered, and all the ritual and rites carried out, shows that Yahweh demands a particular worship in a particular, very strict and well-defined way. You cannot read that and come out with any other interpretation. I mean, he's very specific, down to the nails, into the grommets that hold this all together. Not even nails, probably more like pins. But he's very specific about everything, even what material to use. You know, we'll pick, you know, if metal's high like it is now, we'll pick something else, maybe wood to substitute. Yahweh didn't allow that. You don't substitute anything. The tabernacle was more than a place for Israelites to come and see Yahweh's face. The tabernacle proclaimed to all who entered, Yahweh is the one and only one worshipped here. All worship will be done according to his way and his instructions, all on his terms. It is that fact that stops all false worship dead in its tracks. And it's also what cries out in every facet of his worship. Every article of the temple, and the tabernacle, the furniture, every motion of the priest was dictated and set aside for true worship. Every word recited there was according to Yahweh's plan and according to his command. No other worship is allowed or accepted. Some today might just go ahead and sacrifice a swine on the altar and say it's fine with Yahweh. Antiochus did it, and it sealed his fate. He became the very depiction, the essence of the anti-Messiah. Yahweh says it is his teachings and his word and no other that will be tolerated in his sight. Not even a little deviation is okay. When it comes to true worship, the lessons revealed by the temple are quite clear. You only use Yahweh's fire, not your own. You can't strike your own match, lest you die. You don't touch the ark, lest you die. Yahweh is holy. You call on Him by the holiest of all names. If you use Baal or its equivalent, L-O-R-D, within the walls of the temple, you'll be cast out. The high priest must enter the holiest place only one time on the Day of Atonement, not at any other time. Not on some day the church council said is okay. Can't do it. And if he refuses, the high priest doesn't survive. You come to the temple on the prescribed days, and you have the right sacrifice, the only sacrifice appropriate to your sin, or it'll be rejected. Every aspect of temple worship is precise, regulated, unchangeable. You see, because it reflects the very nature of Yahweh. That's Him right there. That's the way He is right there. To show His worship to all that this is who you're worshiping. And it's different from all other forms of worship. Malachi 3:6 says, I am Yahweh, I change not. I'm not going to vary. I'm not going to equivocate. I'm not going to, well, all right, just this one time. That is why He is so particular about the temple and how it was built and what was put in it and all the details. There are monumental lessons here for us today who live in a deceived world that thinks any beliefs are okay, all beliefs are tolerated and welcome so long as one is sincere. I remember, I might have mentioned this years ago, a minister stood up and opening the legislative session. And he said, in his prayer, he started out, Jehovah, G-O-D, Allah, whatever your name is, it really doesn't matter. We all know that we all worship You. I fell out of my chair when I read that. I was reading it in the minutes. I couldn't believe it. Someone could be that deceived. You know, politics is all about compromise. That's what this man was doing with religion. The temple was always a very highly visible place, and it declared the manner in which Yahweh expected His worship. Yahweh is of the utmost importance. What we believe and what we do matters very much to Him, because that's the way He commanded it. Nothing else will do. All the other nations, well, they go worship on top of the hill, you know. They worship under the groves, under the shade of any tree that's convenient, or whatever. But Yahweh says, My worship is unique. You must come here, you must worship properly, and with the right offering, and you do it My way. I want to look at how Solomon built the temple. Before that, though, we need to clarify something. People talk about the first and second temple. Actually, there were three temples. First, of course, is Solomon's temple, which was designed by David, but built by his son Solomon. It stood for 420 years. Then you have Zerubbabel's, which is commonly called Zerubbabel's temple, which was built after, of course, Persian King Cyrus allowed the Jews to return from Babylon. It stood for 500 years. But then you have Herod's temple, which part of which is still there, and it's usually called the second temple because it amounted to rebuilding of Zerubbabel's rather inferior temple. And it was not a totally new construction, so that's why they get the two temple, or first and second temple, because this was just kind of a rebuild, remodel. Amazingly, he got it done, and 6 years later it was destroyed by the Romans, just as Yahshua said it would be. When he said one stone upon another, remember, would be thrown down. So they destroyed it. It only lasted 6 years. In the year 70, 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 30 reveals how wise Solomon was. 1 Kings chapter 4, and let's look at just verse 30 to start. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan and Ezrahite and Heman and Shalcol and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all nations round about. He spoke 3,000 proverbs. Imagine. And his songs were 1,005. Got a ways to go, Robert. He wrote 1,005 songs. And he spake of trees from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of fowl and of creeping things and of fishes. I guess he had so much knowledge, he just shared, you know, everything, natural knowledge, science, whatever. And there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all kings of the earth, which had heard of his wisdom. David, because of his warrior qualities, was not allowed to build the temple, but he did prepare it, got everything ready to do this, even buying the threshing floor from Ornan, the Jebusite, on Mount Moriah. 1 Kings chapter 5, verse 13. This is amazing. If you think about it, just think about it. What this must have looked like. Boy, I would have loved to have a picture of it. And King Solomon raised a levy out of all Israel, and the levy was 30,000 men. Actually, they call it a levy. He just said, okay, I need 30,000 backs. 30,000 men to work. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month by courses. They could go for a month, and they had leave for 2 months. That's a pretty good deal. They went up to Lebanon, and I'm sure got some cedars and all everything else up there. And Solomon had threescore and 10,000 that bear burdens. So we've got 40,000 people just carrying stuff. And 40,000 hewers in the mountains. They're chopping big blocks of marble and whatever out of the mountains, cutting them out. All those people. And the king commanded, and they brought great stones, costly stones, and huge stones to lay the foundation of the house. And Solomon's builders and Hiram's builders did hew them, and the stone squarers, so they prepared timber and stones to build the house. Amazing. All these men. I didn't add them all up, but it'd be close to, what, 100,000? Just to build this thing. It's amazing what they did back then. Just by the, you know, sweat of their brow and muscle power. Over in 1 Kings 6, this is also fascinating. Verse 6, the nethermost chamber, and it goes to describing this thing, all the different parts of it. He said the nethermost chamber was 5 cubits wide, and the middle was 6 cubits broad, and the third was 7 cubits broad. For without, in the wall of the house, he made narrow rests round about, that the beams should not be fastened in the walls of the house. So he notched it all the way around, notched the stone. And the house, when it was building, was built of stone, made ready before it was brought thither. Prefab, putting it together before they even brought it down. Or at least designing it to be put together, I should say. So that there was neither hammer nor axe, nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was in building. Fascinating. You know, Scripture compares the temple to the body of Messiah in Ephesians chapter 2. The body of Messiah is not artificially forced together, is it? As if against its will, one thing against another that doesn't quite seem to fit, but just, you know, tacked together and nailed together. But the fellowship of saints comes naturally. Naturally, like it was made that way. And it was. And therefore, each member fits naturally in the body with all the others, like with like mind and like heart. Well, we hear all the time from people who say, I feel closer to the people in the faith than I do my own family. And that's what this prefab temple pictures. Note in 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 7, and this had to be the guiding of the Holy Spirit. Nothing else could explain it. 1 Kings chapter 12. 12 verse 7. No, that's the wrong one. It might have been I'm looking for the one that says that the stones were in place without any further modifications. I guess I have the wrong. Anyway, just perfect measurements, just fit perfectly. And it shows how Yahweh chooses and fits us in the body of Messiah. Man doesn't have a hand in it. The body is put together by Yahweh. He adds to the body those that should be saved. So he gives us the gifts we need. We hear from new inquirers who seem to express an amazing perception without having done an awful lot of study. I mean, they say things that, you know, you would think someone studying for 30 years would finally come to understand. But it's their common belief in their willing heart that Yahweh gives them understanding. And then to share a natural common bond with others in the truth. And they fit in immediately. And there was nothing that we had to do to, you know, bring them along. They just kind of fit right in. We see it over and over. In 1 Chronicles chapter 28, David explained that he was a man of war. He couldn't build the temple. 1 Chronicles 28, verse 3. And he says, stood upon his feet and said, "Hear me, my brethren, and my people. As for me, I had in my heart to build a house of rest for the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, and for the footstool of our Elohim, and made ready for the building. But Yahweh said unto me, 'You shall not build a house for me, for my name, because you have been a man of war and have shed blood.'" He said he couldn't do it. So he explains then that he's going to have someone else do it. Verse 4, two notable things. "Howbeit, Yahweh Elohim of Israel chose me before all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever." That's interesting. David's going to be king over Israel forever, and which we find in other passages where he's going to be right under Yahshua in the millennium. "For he has chosen Judah to be the ruler, and the house of Judah, the house of my father, and among the sons of my father, he liked me to make me king over all Israel." And notice verse 9 now. "And you, Solomon, my son, know you the Elohim of my father, and serve him with a perfect heart and with a willing mind. For Yahweh searches all hearts and understands all the imaginations of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found of you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever." Essence of the unpardonable sin right there. If you forsake him, he'll cast you off forever. So be true in your heart and be willing in your heart and mind, because he's going to search the heart. So as long as Solomon remained pure in his worship, he prospered. Boy, did he prosper. We all know how blessed a man he was. And he allowed later on, however, his wives to influence him to pervert the worship Yahweh had given him and to follow idols. 1 Kings 11:1 was his ultimate downfall. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1. "And he fell for three different reasons." Let's look at that. There's a question whether the man will even be in the kingdom. "But King Solomon loved many strange wives, together with the daughter," and by the way, that's foreign wives, "together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidianites, and Hittites." Yahweh says, don't marry them. He didn't care. "Of the nations concerning which Yahweh said of the children of Israel, 'You shall not go in unto them. Surely you... neither shall they come unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their mighty ones.'" Well, Solomon clave unto these in love, it says. This was his downfall. If you go on to read, you'll find that specifically it was these, this problem, his wealth and weapons were his downfall. Deuteronomy 16 to 17, Yahweh specifically commands against these things for a king. Don't multiply these things to yourself. Wealth, weapons, and wives. Solomon practiced a form of of interfaith, you could say, in order to please his wives. And that's a direct affront to Yahweh, and a violation of serving him with a perfect heart, which we read in 1 Chronicles 28:9. So you can't mix worship. You just can't do it. It's been tried. It doesn't work. There have been some who thought it was okay to worship in a feast-keeping group that maybe doesn't use exclusively the sacred name. Thought that was okay. You can't mix truth with error. You need to go beyond these things of the world and not violate the first commandment. Yahshua said in Matthew 4 that we are to worship only Yahweh and to serve only Him. A great lesson in the temple is that Yahweh demands worship only one way. David was true to that precept. Solomon was a different story. He was a compromiser. Thought, well, as long as I can get along with everybody, it'll work well for me, he thought. Well, the temple was built along the same lines, of course, as the tabernacle, but twice as big. Everything was supersized. Being that we have even more specifics about the tabernacle than we do, let's look at it for lessons about true worship. Let's turn to Exodus 25. 15 chapters, Exodus 25 through chapter 40, details the pattern and the construction of the tabernacle. 15 chapters. Does it matter to Yahweh? I think he's very specific, isn't he? The pattern of the tabernacle shows, first of all, a need for, number one, a sacrificial death, as we see pictured in the first object you come to as you go through the gate or whatever, the surrounding fence there, you come to the altar. The altar. It's a lesson for us today. We have to make sacrifice if we expect to approach Yahweh. Sacrifice in what we believe, if necessary, to be in line with what Yahweh's commanded, if we expect to approach Him properly. We must be willing to sacrifice ourselves in our faith. You know, we do that all the time, don't we? We can't do things that others do, say on the Sabbath. We just can't do it. But we sacrifice. And, of course, we give of our time and our labor in sacrifice. If there's one overriding principle that cries out of this book, it's personal sacrifice for Yahweh. Sacrifice in how you live, and if you're unwilling to do that for Yahweh, in order to worship Him as He prescribes, then you have a problem with idolatry. Because the idol is yourself, and anything that comes before Yahweh is idolatry. It's an idol. Anything. I want to look at Exodus chapter 25 and look at verse 8. Start there. I'm not going to go through this whole thing. There's 15. I'm not going to go through 15 chapters, so don't worry. We're just going to hit the high spots. In verse 8, Exodus, and I'll get to 25 here. And let them make me a sanctuary, a kodesh, something set apart, a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. Set apart place. Yahweh dwells in a place that's set apart from the rest. And this is a model of what already exists in the heavens. The tabernacle is built with utmost precision. Worship of Yahweh isn't an approximation. It isn't a half try. It's, oh, that's plenty good enough. It's precise. Like, well, He'll accept it if I'm basically, you know, pretty much averaged out pretty good. He'll accept it. If I have to work on a Sabbath once in a while, He'll understand. Or I'll miss a feast or two, He'll understand. Now imagine a priest serving. We talked about that in the Bible study this morning. How about a priest serving Yahweh? Come to his appointment to serve at the tabernacle or temple. Someone looks around and says, "Where's Zebaniah?" "Oh, he's doing something else this Sabbath. He'll be here next time." Imagine that. How long would Ebaniah? I mean, I wouldn't want to be standing anywhere near the guy. Who knows what'll happen to him? How long do you suppose he would last in that kind of attitude? Yahweh says we're to be a kingdom of priests. We're training for that. Can we just kind of muffle along and, well, plenty good enough. I'm basically trying. Or do we really try? Then you have the bronze altar of sacrifice, which we're talking about as you come in. I guess I got ahead of myself a little bit there. But on this altar, we have innocent animals sacrificed in a ritual that symbolically transferred the guilt and the sin of man to the head of the lamb, ox, dove, whatever it might be. This wasn't about social or civil justice, by the way. If you committed a crime against somebody, you restored. It was restitution. It didn't address a person's debt to society. If you stole your neighbor's donkey, you couldn't just offer a sacrifice on the altar and say, that's fine, like we do today. We pay a fine to the judge and we're off. Poor guy's out a donkey or whatever, but that's our justice today. Under the law of Moses, a thief had to make generous restitution for what he had done against somebody. It wouldn't do any good for a victim of a crime or a sin to have an animal sacrificed on the altar if he was also not recompensed for that crime. And that's why Yahshua, you know, above and beyond animal sacrifice, did what he did. It's because sin had to be paid for, not just covered up. Not just covered by animal blood. And that's the major problem with our injustice system today. Not only are the victims not compensated for the crime too often, but you know, you put the criminal in prison, he pays twice because now he's got to pay the guy's room and board through his taxes. He gets hit twice. When a person became aware of his failure to live up to Yahweh's standards of law, then the bronze altar was there to cover the penalty inflicted and the violation of Yahweh through the blood of an animal. So this is all that's as far as they could go in approaching Yahweh until that's done. Once that's done, they can move on further. In Hebrews 10, Paul wrote that the blood of bulls and goats couldn't ever take away sin. But it says that animal sacrifices were just shadows of another sacrifice that had the power to remove the penalty, which of course we know through Yahshua. Well, the conditions of this offering were very highly symbolic. The person offering the sacrifice brought an unblemished, non-defective animal to the priest. The Israelite identified with the sacrifice by placing his hands on the animal's head. The animal's throat was slit, and the priest collected the blood and disposed of the carcass in the prescribed manner. And if it wasn't done just that way, then he had no sacrifice for his sin. Isaiah said, we all like sheep have gone astray. We've all turned everyone his own way, and Yahweh has laid on him, meaning Yahshua, the iniquity of us all. So it is through Yahshua that we have this sin removed. Bronze basin is what we approach next. Between this sacrificial altar and the tabernacle or the temple proper was a basin you had to wash in. There was water there. This is the precursor to baptism, what they call the mikveh, a ritualistic washing the Jews do. And here the priest, as represented the people, had to wash his hands and his feet before offering a sacrifice or entering the holy place. You can find that in Exodus 30. I'm not going to go into that, but this wash basin shows that Yahweh's attitude about sin is very, very pointed. It's a defilement. It had to be cleansed of. The repeated washings pictured a principle we find throughout the Bible, all the way through, before we can draw close to Yahweh, before we can even get into his presence, we have to be clean. We have to be cleansed, not just in our prayers and fasting and so forth, but in our obedience to him as well. James wrote, draw not near to Elohim, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourself in the sight of Yahweh, and he will lift you up. James 4, 8 to 10. Now, who would attend a, say, the president's going to come visit? He's got a little function down here. Wants to meet you. He sends you a personal invitation. Now, who would go there with mud all over his hands and his feet, over his shoes? How can we come before Yahweh with dirt, with sin? The wash basin says we don't approach Yahweh's presence unless we are clean. And yes, it does indeed matter how we approach him. We don't come to him just as I am, as we've heard the song sung thousands of times. This spiritual cleansing has lots of prophetic implications. If you turn to Ezekiel chapter 11, even in prophetic terms, in chapter 11, verse 17, we find, it says, therefore say, thus says Yahweh Elohim, I will even gather you from the people and assemble you out of the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And they shall come thither, and they shall take away all the detestable things thereof, and all the abominations thereof from hence. And I will give them one heart, and I'll put a new spirit within you, and I will take the stony heart out of their flesh, and will give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes, and keep my ordinances, and do them. And they shall be my people, and I will be their Elohim. But as for those whose heart walks after the heart of their detestable things, and after their abominations, I will recompense their way upon their own heads, says Yahweh Elohim. So, before Yahshua comes to his throne, a day of personal and national cleansing has to take place. See, Yahweh will not live among his people while sin is rampant. Yahweh will not allow anyone into his kingdom whom he can't rule. Is obedience important? You tell me. Now we enter the holy place. You know, the tabernacle was kind of dull on the outside. You know, you see these depictions, and that's right. I mean, skins and stuff over the top. I mean, it looked kind of drab. But man, the inside was something else. The interior was great. The exterior was, you know, goat's hair and ram skins. But rich color on the inside. Embroidery, gold, lit by one thing. A huge menorah up in the corner as you come in. Was the only light. You see this gold all over, you know, just reflecting this. Must have been something awesome. To the outsider, living for Yahweh doesn't look too appealing. You got to do that, and you got to do that. But to the person who shows faith in Yahweh and through his life, hey, it's wonderful, isn't it, to live for Yahweh? It's a wonderful discovery. Beautiful joy and harmony. Ask somebody who's turned away from Yahweh if their life has turned better. Their family life better? You tell me. Are things going better? Or does it work better in harmony with Yahweh? So the thrill of drawing near to Yahweh can be known only by those who enter in, just as we do with the tabernacle. Then you got the menorah. We need the light of Yahweh's word to reveal his ways. The lampstand foreshadows Yahshua as the way and the light. And we know that the city of New Jerusalem in the kingdom itself will be lighted by the glory of Yahshua, Revelation 21:23. So we have more prophecy tied up in this structure. Then you got the golden table of showbread to the right of the lampstand in this 15-by-30-foot room. It was a golden table on which flat loaves of bread, of course, were there, 12 loaves for the 12 tribes of Israel. Yahshua one day explained that he is the bread of life. Who comes to me shall never hunger. Then you have the altar of incense, the next stop on our way through our little tour here. This altar stood just before the curtain of the most holy place. And as we near it, As we draw near to Yahweh, our prayers become very key. That's what incense represents, of course. And Revelation 8, verse 3, I want to look at that real quickly, says, "And another angel came and stood at the altar having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before Yahweh out of the angel's hands." The altar of incense teaches us the need for constant prayer. Sometimes we have problems because we're not praying enough. You can't come into Yahweh's presence without it. And then we have inside the holy place, which is called, people call it the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, a golden covered treasure chest, unlike anything you've ever seen. Had a pot of manna, Aaron's staff, and two tables of the law. And on the top was a golden cover called the mercy seat, because that's where Yahweh, symbolically, even literally at times, dwelled, sitting at the ends where cherubim looking down. Each object was rich in its meaning, and they represented the only conditions by which Yahweh would live with his people. You got the stone tablets Moses brought down from Sinai. Reminds us of what Yahweh stands for. His standards are as sure and as reliable as natural gravity, as falling off a building and traveling 120 miles an hour till you hit the ground and you suffer the consequences. Or you drink some poison, there's going to be adverse effects. Same thing with Yahweh's spiritual laws too. We have the freedom to do as we wish with Yahweh's laws. He can create, we can create him in whatever image we like, saying things like, "I'll call him whatever I want. He knows who I mean. I'll worship him on whatever day I choose." We can dishonor our parents. We can lie. We can cheat, kill, covet. We can, break all sorts of restraints, declare sin acceptable, legitimate, proper, good, and declare the Sabbath and feast null and void. We can do all that, but when we do, we break Yahweh's laws. Our actions will come back on us every time. By reflecting on the laws of Yahweh, we see not only what is right about Yahweh, but what is wrong with us, with ourselves. Because his laws are at the foundation of everything. This is his very nature. His laws depict who he is and what he expects. Yahweh knew that his people would sin against him. He knew that his people would break his laws, ignore his leaders and prophets, and history tells the story. Our forefathers resisted the prophets. They grumbled and complained about what Yahweh provided for them. And they got tired of obedience. They wanted to go back to Egypt. It was much easier back there, they thought. Short memories. We all have short memories. We forget all the bad stuff. We remember, tending to remember the good stuff always. But they wanted to be slaves to sin. And that's what sin, of course, creates, slaves. That's why James calls it the perfect law of liberty. You're not slave to sin when you obey the law. Well, after a while, it becomes a little bit just too difficult for people. And the world is just pulling too hard on them. It's too demanding, too hard. We start to look with our eyes and not with our hearts. We're fooled by the appearance of things. We begin to doubt. Our sins draw us farther and farther away until we just get caught up in an avalanche of sin. Without his mercy, it would all be over for us, but the atonement cover of that mercy seat, which points to Yahshua's sacrifice, is the key. It comes into view, and when we return and repent, it comes into play. Those eyes of the cherubim, as I mentioned, were looking down. They didn't look at the priest coming in every day, going out. They were looking focused down on that mercy seat. Yahweh wanted man to realize that in order to approach him, we had to conform to him. And as we see the threat of forces today intent on destroying our world, It's time we take to heart the meaning of the tabernacle and start letting it speak to us. It's time this temple called our bodies reflects the temple of true worship. In our day, right and wrong are being turned upside down, inside out. Good is seen as evil. Evil's good. They even call good things bad now. That's bad, meaning that's good. Truth is fallen in the streets. The heart of many is waxing cold. Prophecy is just being fulfilled right and left. And if you can't see that, you're blind. You're blind. Just read it. And then look out. Read the paper, anything. Look at the news and see if that doesn't bear out. Well, let's move now from this small physical structure that we talked about and understood as just a type of our lives as well, to the kingdom, which is our goal. John must have been blown away when he saw Yahweh's majesty, Revelation 21, 22. He describes a little bit of it in the New Jerusalem. He says in verse 9, Revelation 21, 9, there came unto me one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials full of the seven last plagues, and talked with me, saying, come hither, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from Elohim, having the glory of Elohim, and her light was like unto a stone most precious, even like jasper stone, clear as crystal, and had a wall great and high, and had 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Extremely high city. Very high. There's no other need really for that wall except to show that you have to go through one of the 12 tribes to reach the kingdom. Then just read on through. It's just amazing what you can just try to follow with your mind, how beautiful this is and what a place. And then you go on to chapter 22, verse 14. Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life and may enter in through the gates into the city. You see, you have to have the delegated authority to enter the city. You can't just walk in. And you get that through what we just read here. They that do his commandments have the right, have that authority, have that delegated authority of Yahweh to go in. You have in, if you measure the city, let's go back to chapter 21, verse 15. He talked with me and had a golden reed to measure the city and the gates thereof and the wall thereof. And the city lies foursquare, and the length as large as the width. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. The length and the breadth and the height are all equal. Figure that out. If you figure what they considered a furlong back then, you've got 14 or 15 cubic miles. 14 or 15,000 cubic miles, in all directions. Up, this way, that way. 14 to 15 cubic miles cubed. Things going to stick out of the earth like you wouldn't believe. Isn't that amazing? What is interesting, you look at verse 18, and the building of the wall of it was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like under the clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, and the fourth an emerald. Many of these are the same stones found in the priest's breastplate of the high priest. They all mean something. They all have a particular meaning to Yahweh. I can't say I understand what they mean, these different stones, but they're there. Chapter 22, verse 1, and he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of Elohim and of the Lamb. In the midst of the street of it, And on either side of the river there was the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. To give life. That's what that tree was for, to give life. Yahweh, you know, lets us a little bit to see into the kingdom, city, structure. But we don't really know an awful lot about the government of that city and his kingdom. And exactly just what we're going to be doing. We know indications in Isaiah and other places that there will be guidance from Yahweh's people who were considered worthy to be in that kingdom. They're going to teach others, show them how that Yahweh works and how his government works. But we don't know, you know, specifically how it's all going to fit. I guess that's not for us to know at this point. But if we're faithful, we could be there. The feasts, feast days, tell us all about how Yahweh and his plan work. They tell us more about how we perhaps one day will fit into that than anything else. They're about serving Yahweh and serving the brethren. Administering is government. And that is what we're all about, brethren. Learning how to do that now among the brethren. To someday fit into that kingdom in a greater way. Learning the mind of Yahweh through following his will and obeying him. So one day we can serve him as well through an eternity. I was going to read number 6, but for the interest of time, I think we'll forego that. But just think of the marvelous design Yahweh had from the beginning, because he knows the end from the beginning. He knows how everything is going to work out, and his plan is still in operation. It's still going. And we can be a part of that plan if we're faithful to him. And may each of us desire to have that time that we can be with him as we strive in these days of trial and persecution, that one day keep our eye on that kingdom. That's what we're all about. That's what we've got to sustain us every day as we strive to walk that narrow way. May Yahweh bless you.